Such was the speed of the truck now that he was under fire for only seconds, and the gunner's aim could not follow it as it raced down onto the concrete loading bank and slammed into the buffers. The force of the impact was brutal, and Mark was hurled from his perch. The rifle strap snapped, and the weapon sailed away, and Mark turned in the air and hit the sloping concrete ramp on his side with a crash that jarred his teeth in his head. The rough concrete ripped away the thick barathea cloth from his hip and leg and shoulder and seared the flesh beneath with gravel burn. He came up at last against a stack of yellow-painted oil drums, and his first concern was to roll onto his back and stare upwards. He was under the headgear now, protected from the gunner by the legs and intricate steel girders of the tower itself, and he pulled himself to his feet, dreading the give and crippling drag of broken bone. But though his body felt crushed and bruised, he could still move, and he hobbled to where his rifle lay. The strap was broken, and the butt was cracked and splintered, and as he lifted it, it snapped into two pieces. He could not fire from the shoulder. The foresight had been knocked off, and the broken metal had a sugary grey crystalline look. He could not aim the weapon. He would have to get close, very close. There was a deep, bright scar in the steel of the breech. He muttered a prayer, "Please God," as he tried to work the bolt open. It was jammed solid, and he struggled with it fruitlessly for precious seconds. "All right," he thought grimly. No butt to hold to the shoulder, no foresight with which to aim, and only the one cartridge in the breech. This is going to be interesting. He looked around him quickly. Beneath the steel tower, the two square openings to the main shaft were set into the concrete collar, protected by screens of steel mesh. The one cage stood at the surface station, doors open, ready for the next shift. The other was at the bottom station, 1,000 feet below ground level. They had stood that way for months now. On the far side was the small service elevator, which would take maintenance teams 100 feet to the summit of the tower in half a minute. However, there was no power on the shaft head, and the elevator was useless. The only other way up was the emergency ladder. This was an open steel stairway that spiraled up around the central shaft, protected only by a low handrail of inch piping. High above Mark's head, the Vickers fired again, and Mark heard a scream of agony out there on the roadway. It hastened him, and he limped to the stairway. The steel mesh gate was open, the padlock shattered, and Mark knew by what route the sniper had reached his roost. He stepped onto the stairway and began to climb, following the coils up the casing, round and round and up and up. Always at his right hand, the open black mouth of the shaft gaped, an obscene dark orifice in the earth's surface, dropping straight and sheer into the very bowels, 1,000 dark, terrifying feet. Mark tried to ignore it, dragging his bruised and aching body up by the handrail, carrying the broken weapon in his other hand, and strained his neck backwards for the first glimpse of the gunner above. The Vickers fired again, and Mark glanced sideways. He was high enough now to see into the road. One of the trucks was burning a tall dragon's breath of smoke and sullen flame pouring into the sky, and the drab khaki bodies were still strewn in the open, death's discarded toys. Even as he watched, the Vickers' fire thrashed over them, mangling already dead flesh, and Mark's anger became cold and bright as a dagger's blade. "Keep firing, love," Fergus croaked in that husky stranger's voice. "Short bursts. Count to 20 slowly. And then a touch on the bottom. I want him to think that I am still up here." He pulled the Webley from his belt and crawled on his belly towards the head of the steep staircase. "Don't leave me, Fergus. It'll be all right," he tried to grin, but his face was grey and crumpled. "Just you keep firing. I'm going down to meet him halfway. He'll not expect that." "I don't want to die alone," she breathed. "Stay with me. I'll be back, love. Don't fuss yourself." And he slid on his belly into the opening of the staircase. She felt like a child again, in one of those terrible dark nightmares, trapped and enmeshed in her own fate, and she wanted to cry out. The sound reached her lips but died there as a slow, blubbering moan. A rifle bullet chunked into the barricade of timber beside her. They were shooting from down below. She could not pick them out, for they were hidden in the ditches, and the irregularities of the ground, screened by long purple shadows, and her eyes were blurred with tears and with exhaustion. Yet she found the last few grains of her strength and crawled to the gun. She squatted behind it, and her hands were almost too small to reach the firing button. She pressed the barrel downwards and forced her blaring vision to focus, marvelling at the little toy figures in the field of the sight. The gun juddered in her hands like a living creature. "A short burst," she whispered to herself, repeating Fergus' instructions, and lifted her thumbs from the firing button. "One, two, three," and she began to count to the next burst. Mark paused at the next burst of firing and stood for a moment staring up. He was over halfway to the top, and now he could make out the floor of the service platform below the winch wheels, the platform on which the Vickers was sighted. There were narrow cracks in the woodwork through which bright lines of open sky showed clearly, and as he watched he saw one of the lines of light interrupted by a dark movement beyond. It was that flicker of movement that caught his attention, and he realized that he was looking at the body of the person who served the gun. He must be squatting directly over one of the narrow joints in the floor of a platform, and his movements blocked out part of that bright line of light. A bullet through the gap would cripple and pin him. But he glanced at the broken weapon in his hand, and knew that he would have to get closer, much closer. He began to run upwards, and though he tried to keep his weight lightly on the balls of his feet, the hobnails in his boots rang on the steel stairs. Fergus MacDonald heard them, and checked his own run, shrinking into the protective lee of one of the steel girders. "One man only," he muttered, "but coming up fast." He dropped on one knee and peered down through the gaps between the stairs, hoping for a sight of the man who he was hunting. The steps overlapped each other like fan playing cards, and the lateral supports of the tower formed an impenetrable steel forest below him. The only way he could hope for a glimpse was to hang out over the handrail and look down the central shaft well. The idea of that 1,000-foot black hole repelled him, and he had formed an estimate of his opponent high enough to guess that the reward for putting his head over the side would be a bullet between the eyes. He edged into a better position where he could cover the next spiral of staircase below him. "I'll let him come up to me," he decided, and braced his arm against the girder at the level of his chin, and laid the Webley over the crook of his elbow to give the heavy pistol support. He knew that over 10 paces it was wildly inaccurate, but the dead rest would give him at least one fair shot. He cocked his head slightly to listen to the clatter of booted feet on steel, and he judged that the man was very close. One more spiral of the stair would bring him into shot. Carefully he thumbed back the hammer of the Webley and looked down over the slotted rear sight. Above them the Vickers fired again, and Mark paused to catch his breath and check the situation of the gunner, and to his dismay he realized that he had climbed too high in the tower. He had changed the angle of sight and could no longer see through the cracks in the timber platform. He had to retreat carefully down the staircase before once again the bright lines of light opened in the dark underbelly of timber. A vague blur of movement reassured him that the gunner had not changed his position. He was still squatting over the joint, but the shot was almost impossible. He was shooting directly upwards, awkward even in the best conditions. But now he had no butt to steady the rifle and no foresight. He was shooting into a single dark mass of timber and had to guess the position of the crack because the gunner's body obscured the light from the far side. The crack itself was only 2 inches wide, and if he missed by a smallest fraction, the bullet would bury itself harmlessly in the thick timber. He tried not to think that there would be only one shot. The jammed breech made that certain. He put his hip to the guardrail and leaned out over the open shaft, squinted upwards, trying to set the target in his mind as he lifted the broken rifle in an easy, natural movement. He knew that he had to make the shot entirely by instinct. He had no chance if he hesitated or tried to hold his aim steadily on the target. He swept up the shattered weapon, and at the moment the long barrel aligned, he pressed the trigger. In the flash and thunder of the shot, a tiny white splinter of wood jumped from the edge of the crack. The bullet had touched wood, and Mark felt an instant of utter dismay. Then the body that had obscured the light was jerked abruptly aside, and the crack was a single uninterrupted line again, and on the platform somebody screamed. Helena MacDonald had just reached the count of 20 again, and was aiming at a gathering of men she could see grouping beyond one of the lorries. She squatted low over the gun and was on the point of jamming her thumbs down on the firing button when the bullet came up through the floor timbers. It had touched one of the hard mahogany balks, just enough to split the casing of the bullet and alter its shape, mushrooming it slightly so that it did not enter her body through a neat round puncture. It tore a ragged entry into the soft flesh at the juncture of her slightly spread thighs and plunged upwards through her lower abdomen, striking and shattering the thick bony girdle of her pelvis, glancing off the bone with still enough impetus to bruise and weaken the lower branch of the descending aorta, the great artery that runs down from the heart, before going on to embed itself in the muscles high on the left side of her back. It lifted Helena into the air and hurled her across the platform onto her face. "Oh God, oh God, oh God, help me, Fergus! Fergus, I don't want to die alone!" she screamed, and the sound carried clearly to the two men in the steel tower below her. Mark recognized the voice instantly. It did not need the name to confirm it. His mind shied at the enormity of what he had done. The broken rifle almost slipped from his hands, but he saved it and caught at the handrail for support. Helena cried again, a sound without words. It was exactly that strange, wild cry that she had uttered at the zenith of one of their wildest flights of passion together, and for an instant Mark remembered her face, shining and triumphant, the dark eyes burning and the open red mouth, and the soft pink petal of her tongue aflutter. Mark started to run, hurling himself upwards. The screams caught Fergus like a flight of arrows in the heart, a piercing physical agony. He dropped the pistol to his side and stood irresolute, staring upwards, not knowing what had happened, except that Helena was dying. He had heard the death scream too often to have any doubt about that. What he was listening to was mortal agony, and he could not force his body to begin the climb upwards to the horror he knew that waited him there. While he hesitated, Mark came around the angle of the staircase, and Fergus was not ready for him. The pistol was at his side, and he fell back and tried to bring it up, to fire at point-blank range into the chest of the uniformed figure. Mark was as off balance as he was. He had not expected to run into another enemy, but he saw the pistol and swung the broken rifle at Fergus's head. Fergus ducked, and the Webley fired wide. The bullet flew inches past Mark's temple, and the report slammed against his eardrum and made him flinch his head. The rifle struck the girder behind Fergus and was jerked from Mark's grip. Then they came together, chest to chest. Mark seized the wrist of his pistol hand and held with all his strength. Neither of them had recognized the other. Fergus had aged into a grey caricature of himself, and his eyes were shaded by the cloth cap. Mark was in unfamiliar uniform, dusty and bloodied, and he had changed also. Youth had become man. Mark was taller, but they were matched in weight, and Fergus was endowed with the terrible fighting rage of the berserker, which gave him superhuman strength. He drove Mark back against the guardrail and bowed his back over the open shaft. But Mark still had his pistol wrist, and the weapon was pointed up over his head. Fergus was sobbing wildly, driving with all the wiry, uncanny strength of a body tempered by hard physical work, and fired now by the strength of anger and sorrow and despair. Mark felt his feet slip, the hobnails of his boots skidding on the steel steps, and he went over further, feeling the mesmeric suck of 1,000 feet of open space plucking at his back. Above them, Helena screamed again, and the sound drove like a needle into the base of Fergus' brain. He shuddered, and his body convulsed in one great rigid spasm that Mark could not hope to hold. He went backwards over the guardrail, but still he had his grip on Fergus's gun hand, and his other arm he had wound about his shoulders. They slid into the void, locked together in a horrible parody of a lover's embrace. But as they started to fall, Mark hooked both legs over the rail like a trapeze artist and jerked to a halt, hanging upside down into the shaft. Fergus was somersaulted over him by the force of his own thrust. As he turned in the air, the cloth cap flew from his head, and he was torn from the arm that Mark had around his shoulder.